Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley, traffic on the 10 westbound, a crash at Central blocks the shoulder. Well, if you spend any time outside today, it is not a surprise that we are still under an excessive heat warning. That'll last until Thursday evening. Look for a high today of 111. 105 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. 112 for a high both tomorrow and Thursday. It's 106 degrees right now at KJZZ. A plan that could force dozens of low-income seniors out of their city-owned apartment complex is slowing down. Phoenix's housing department wants to sell the 56-unit property north of the popular Roosevelt Row Arts District to a developer that would bring a large mixed-income complex. Housing Director Cindy Stotler told the city's Housing and Development Subcommittee the city will pay to relocate residents.
We offered to prioritize them in any one of the 13 properties that we own, so they would not have to go on a waiting list. They could get into whichever property they like. And then they can also come back. And we offer to prioritize their return and work with the developer when it returns.
The housing department had planned to ask the city council to approve advertising the sale before its summer break, but now staff will gather more information and input from neighbors and pitch the plan again this fall. The uncomfortably high temperatures are leading more people to turn their ACs on high. As KJZZ's Catherine Fritke reports, that means energy consumption is also up.
With record high temperatures on Sunday, Salt River Project saw an all-time record for peak energy use. Jeff Lane with SRP says customers used more than 6,800 megawatts that day, which is unusual.
To have our peak demand record set on weekends because businesses are often closed on the weekend, and that takes a little bit of a load off of our system. But still, you know, the high temperatures, the higher overnight low temperatures, those all kind of add to the demand.
Lane also says it's early for record energy consumption to occur. He says records are more often broken later in the monsoon season. Arizona Public Service, or APS, says they did register high usage, but no records were set. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Cedar Fire in eastern Arizona is growing. For an update, I'm joined by Fire Information Officer Mike Johnson. And Mike, where does the fire stand right now?
Sure. As of this morning, we're at 37,500 acres, and our containment is at 20%. Folks may notice that the containment has reduced from the last several days. Our highest was 40% a few days ago. And the reason for that decrease is because it's a percentage. So as the number of acres increase, the amount of line that we are certain is holding would decrease until we can, you know, increase that amount of line.
What is the weather like up there today?
Today, the weather activity, it's not as hot and as dry as we've been having the last several days. We're starting to get a little bit of subtropical moisture coming into the area, which is having a moderating effect on fire behavior. Definitely not enough moisture that, you know, we're going to say this thing is put out, but it's definitely helping with the fire behavior and fire activity. It's reducing that for us.
And how are crews fighting this one?
You know, of course, crew, firefighter safety is our number one priority with this. So we're making sure we're engaging at the right time, the right place to work on this fire. A lot of it has been working by doing some burnout operations. So trying to burn from an established roadway, dozer line, natural features, burning that fuel out towards the main fire where we can keep our fire crews safe, but also trying to widen a defensible line of firefighting.
Do you have any estimate at this point of when you might reach full containment?
At this time, we don't have a containment date set forward.
And how about residents? Are they still on pre-evacuation notice?
Yeah, none of the evacuations have gone up or down in the last day. Everybody that was still under pre-evacuation is still under that pre-evacuation notice. It's also a good time to point out that, you know, not only residents that might be impacted by the Cedar Fire, but, you know, there's several other fires going through Arizona right now and across the whole Southwest, and people should use this as an opportunity to think about ready, set, go, you know, how they're going to prepare if they may not be impacted by this fire, but another fire that may start, you know, folks can use this as an opportunity to start thinking about how they would evacuate if that were to happen for them.
Mike Johnson is a fire information officer on the Cedar Fire, which, as he said, has now burned more than 37,000 acres in eastern Arizona. Several communities near the Cedar Fire are under pre-evacuation notices right now, and the Red Cross reports they've already hosted almost 100 families overnight at two shelters they've set up near the fire. At every shelter, people can come for medical attention, for a fresh meal, and to get a roof over their heads. But they can also come to get some emotional first aid during a disaster. And the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with one of the volunteers who's helping victims with their mental health needs at the Cedar Fire. And Lauren, where exactly were you able to reach him?
So I got a hold of Paul Ellis as volunteers were closing up the shelter in Snowflake and moving north to set up a new one at the high school in Holbrook. Ellis is the lead chaplain for the city of Maricopa and the Arizona State Representative for the International Conference of Police Chaplains. But when he's helping the Red Cross on a scene, he says he's just a volunteer. He does this kind of work here in Arizona and all over the country during natural disasters and in emergency situations. And I asked him to describe the work he's doing at the shelter right now.
What I'm involved in would be the mental health area, making sure that people just have somebody to tell their story to, sit down and talk with them and listen to them and encourage them, provide some support and maybe some a perspective that they're not being able to see during the time of a disaster. We're not there trying to analyze people. We're just trying to be there to encourage them.
And what kind of issues are people dealing with when they're in the middle of a disaster like this?
Most of the issues that they're dealing with is the unknown. They come in here, you know, they've left their belongings behind, depending on the circumstances. Everything they own, their possessions are sitting back at home and they're not sure if their house is going to be intact when they return. And it's the uncertainty of the future that most people are concerned about. And so you just try and redirect their thoughts to the fact that our first responders are doing the best job they can, and we're hoping that they're going to be able to go back to their house just as it was before.
Did they find comfort in that? Is it as simple as just needing someone to talk to?
Most of the time, it's just a time to provide some first aid in the emotional sense, and let them be able to express themselves. Most of those issues can be dealt with just by sitting down and just discussing it and being able to clear their mind of what is really concerning them. And then assuring them that their feelings that they're going through at that particular time are a natural response in an abnormal situation, because a fire is not a normal experience that we typically have. But the feelings that we do have as a result of that are a normal reaction to that abnormal situation. And a lot of the issues that people have today emotionally are because they don't know who to sit down and talk to, where to get a fresh perspective, and where to have somebody help direct their thought process to get away from a negative approach to perhaps a positive side of it and looking at the alternatives. It's almost like they become tunnel vision and they can't see either side. They're looking just in one direction. And our job is to help them see the whole perspective.
This must get difficult, though. Like, you're taking on so many people's problems and issues and hearing about those difficult things all day. Do you feel like you make a big difference while you're there?
I hope so. I'll give you an illustration. Up in the fires in Washington a year ago, I was at Okanagan, on the Okanagan fires, and I would work from about 8 o'clock in the morning till about 11 o'clock at night, and people were lined up at the door wanting to come in and sit down and just talk. And those people, it was as a result of that fire, it was pulling up other issues in their life. Some of them marital problems, some of them, you know, any number of issues. And I was able to sit along with the team that I had there with me. We were able to sit and provide some encouragement, some counsel, some direction, some even marital counseling in the midst of the turmoil, because this, the situation that they were in, ignited something that was deep down that had never been resolved. And so then they come back and they send you a letter later on, or a thank you note saying, thank you, you helped us, our lives are back on track, or thanks for the encouragement that you gave us. That's where really it paid off. And I really appreciate that response. But typically they don't have my information, so they don't know how to get in touch with me.
So do you feel fulfilled doing this?
Oh, I love doing this. It's my passion. One of my core values is to be constantly helping the people of the community that I live in and serve and those around the nation.
Well, I'm sure I speak for all of us here when I say thank you so much for your work.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
And that was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Paul Ellis, who's a mental health volunteer serving now near the Cedar Fire in eastern Arizona.
Arizona ranks 45th in the country in an annual report on child welfare. That's one spot higher than last year. The Kids Count report looks at 16 areas, including education, health, and economic well-being. Arizona improved in 12 of them, but even in several of those, the state is still worse than the national average. With me to talk about the 2016 Kids Count report is Dana Namark, president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. So, Dana, overall, how would you say we're doing?
We're doing about the same as we have been doing, which we're in the bottom 10 of the country. It's nice that we moved up one notch, so that's a little bit of good news. And within that overall ranking, there's some very good news about eighth grade math scores. But overall, there's some very frightening statistics here that should be a call to action for us.
Well, you talk about frightening numbers. What to you is the most frightening?
Two are the most frightening, where we rank 48th. One of those is preschool participation. And it sounds so simple, but it can change so much if we actually focus on that. We have very few children participating in preschool, which means many children come to kindergarten already behind. And it's extremely hard for them to ever catch up, no matter what their teachers do, what their schools do. So it's important that we elevate that. And we're talking about all types of preschools. It's not one mandated kind of preschool. So that includes faith-based preschool, your neighborhood child care center, Head Start, preschools run by a school district, the whole range. And what we want is for children to have quality early learning experiences.
And what's the second number that you find particularly frightening?
The second one is children living in high poverty areas. So it's children who live in neighborhoods that have a child poverty rate over 30%.
You mentioned Arizona has moved up nationally one spot from the last report. Is that due to what's going on here, or have other states just fallen further behind?
That's a great question, and it's always a combination when you're looking at rankings. So what's happening in other states obviously affects the rankings. But the biggest impact on us moving up was our jump in eighth grade math proficiency. And we're very excited to see that because Arizonans worked very hard to raise math standards. This was before the Common Core controversy, and even before Common Core, we worked to raise our math standards, and teachers worked very hard to prepare students to meet those standards, and we're seeing the results of that in the numbers. So that's exciting in an era where we talk about how important STEM education is and that we need a high-tech workforce for a high-tech economy going forward.
On those math numbers, though, Arizona clearly has improved, but still nearly two-thirds of Arizona eighth graders are not proficient in math. That seems like kind of a tricky thing to celebrate.
Right. We should celebrate progress, but we need to keep our eye on the goals. And certainly, we are not where we want to be on any of these indicators. There are 16 measures in this annual report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and Arizona has a long way to go to meet our goals. But it helps, I think, to set some incremental goals and to celebrate incremental progress.
I wanted to ask you about that because in a lot of these areas, Arizona is improving, yet is still worse off than the national average. So how do you sort of reconcile we're making progress, but we're still really not doing all that fantastically?
I think we need to celebrate progress and we need to always try to build on that progress. So in some ways, I think looking at how we compare to ourselves over history is more important than how we compare to other states. Yet, we don't want our children to be behind children in 49 other states. And in some cases, that's what we see. Now, one example is children without health insurance. We rank 47th in this report. We certainly expect to see that improve as Kids Care enrollment begins again starting September 1. So we're excited to see the needle move on that indicator.
Dana Namark is president and CEO of Children's Action Alliance. We were talking about the 2016 Kids Count report. We'll post a link to it at theshow.kjzz.org. Dana, thanks.
Thank you.
It's the show on 91.5 for Tuesday, June 21st. Along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Mark Brody. In a bit of very expensive global political theater, NATO went to great lengths this month to show it means business and would stand against Russia if Vladimir Putin launched an invasion into a country besides already war-torn Ukraine or occupied and annexed Crimea. Do the Baltics feel safe, or Poland, which is right at the center of all this? NATO's training exercise, Operation Anaconda 16, had more than 31,000 troops from 24 nations simulating what would happen in a Russian attack on Poland. Putin downplayed the whole thing last weekend, saying NATO was only trying to justify its existence with these war games.
What they need is an external enemy. Otherwise, no one would think why this organization is needed. There is no more Warsaw Pact, neither the USSR. Why would they need it? If we stick to this very logic, the scaremongering, that's probably the way to a Cold War. Our logic is of a different aim at finding compromises and negotiations and cooperation.
Russian President Vladimir Putin speaking to CNN's Fareed Zakaria at a panel discussion in St. Petersburg over the weekend. Other Russian officials this week and last have angrily denounced the banning of the Russian track and field team from participating in the upcoming Summer Olympics in Rio. It's the first time in history an entire team has been banned from participation because of doping. Russian officials said this was another sign of the West treating Russia unfairly. Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Kimberly, professor, welcome.
Thank you, John.
Let's just talk generally. What's the Russian reaction, the Putin reaction to the ban, the war games, just this whole sense as the summer begins?
Well, you know, it's really kind of amusing because, of course, Putin is the one who needs an external enemy to keep his internal regime in power. Nobody would tolerate his authoritarianism if they didn't think that there was an external enemy that they had to fight against. And in terms of saying that the Olympic ban has anything to do with the West, these are global organizations. They're not Western organizations. And also, there have been Western teams that have been affected by the rulings that have come out from these groups.
So can the Russians really say never mind about the Olympics and not suffer some sort of domestic problem once there's no Russian flag on the podium?
It's really going to be a dilemma for Putin because his primary goal is to make Russia a great power again. And obviously, the Soviet Union always did so well in the Olympics. It was sort of part of how the Soviet Union portrayed its glory internationally. And now to have that fall apart because of accusations of corruption that touch very closely to the top of his regime, including him himself, it's an embarrassment. And so he's going to have a hard time figuring out this one.
Some members of the EU have warned that it may be scaremongering, in the words of Vladimir Putin, to pursue a aggressive NATO policy on the border with Russia. Here's German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier warning that a saber-rattling and war crimes directed at Russia is wrong, and anyone who believes that symbolic tank parades on the alliance's eastern border will increase security is wrong. Is that a widely held view within the EU, and is that something that the Obama administration and NATO is likely to take to heart?
Well, I think there's some countries in the EU that are split, and Germany is one of them. But there is a very strong sense among an important group of German leaders that Russia really violated the entire understanding of what the post-Cold War order was supposed to be like when it unilaterally invaded Crimea, because borders were not supposed to be changed that way. And so Germany is one of the places where we're seeing that kind of disagreement come to the forefront. But I think it's too early to say that the people who are more cooperative in orientation towards Russia are the ones who are going to come out on top. Certainly, Putin is very happy to see any kind of dissension that is possible within NATO. He would like to see NATO fall apart. And so that certainly is something that he welcomes.
So let's make you the president of Latvia. How safe are you feeling right now after these war games?
You know, I don't think it's the war games themselves that make a difference. It's the fact that NATO is paying attention to the Baltics and to Poland and saying we haven't forgotten you and we are not going to desert you. Because a year or two ago, everybody was saying, oh, it would never be in U.S. interest to actually come to the defense of the Baltics. And so we should just maybe leave the Baltics to hang out to dry. It was a mistake to let them into NATO to start with.
Is that what this war games did in kind of a way? Because if they'd done a war game simulating an invasion of Estonia or something, that would have been much more provocative than Poland. Does anyone really expect that Poland would be a target?
Well, it depends what you mean by target. I don't think anybody is actually expecting that it is in Russia's interest to have a land-based typical military invasion of any NATO country. So the question is whether they would try to somehow disrupt something at a political level, create a situation of tension and riots.
With Russian speakers inside the Baltics, for instance.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And what Putin is really good at doing is surprising people, at pulling things out of a hat that nobody was expecting. And so I don't think that this shows that we are ready to take on anything that Putin might come up with. Instead, it shows that we are paying attention to what Putin is doing, and that the Baltics are part of the NATO alliance that are still very important, and that nobody is ignoring them.
Okay, so the rabbit Putin pulls out of the hat this week is something to manipulate the vote on Brexit. Do you think he's pro or anti Brexit?
Well, I think he would be interested in anything that causes the European Union to fall apart. And so he's also been demonstrated that he is funding or supporting nationalist political parties throughout Europe. And so it would be very much in his interest to see any kind of disruption in the Western economy, any kind of disruption in the European Union. I'm sure he'd be happy if Brexit succeeds.
So that's a leave vote there. So finally, has he bought time with oil prices stabilized at this higher level?
It's very interesting that what Putin and his team have done is allowed the ruble to fall. And so as a result, they have actually continued to make money even with lower oil prices because, of course, when the ruble falls with the dollar and oil is traded in dollars, it still means that there are rubles coming into the economy. And so he's played that one very well.
Never bet against the brain of an oligarch, I guess. That's
well,
the rule there.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But the other thing to keep in mind is that the real problem with the Russian economy is that it hasn't been decentralized. It hasn't been privatized. It is still being run in a very inefficient way with lots of corruption.
Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me back, John.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
Ah, nature. Relaxing, isn't it? Or is it? Maybe this is more your speed. You know, the sounds of the city. It's easy to assume most people would find babbling brooks and chirping birds more calming than honking horns and whizzing traffic, but new research from the U of A says that's not necessarily the case. It looked at what helped people self-control, tasks like staying on budget and turning down dessert, and found different strokes, or in this case environments, for different folks. Mary Brooks is a professor in the Eller School of Management at the U of A and a co-author of the paper. And Mary, what are the determining factors for who'd benefit from camping or a day at the beach versus those who need to be doing city tours?
We identified a psychological dimension called neuroticism. And what that means in everyday language is your tendency to worry or experience anxiety on a regular basis. So what we found is that for people that are low in anxiety, the nature recommendation holds. People who are low in anxiety perform self-control tasks better when exposed to nature. But the opposite was true for people who are high in neuroticism. They actually perform better when they're exposed to more threatening or more stimulating, more challenging, more dynamic cues.
Well, how do you explain the relationship between the amount that somebody worries in their day-to-day life and which type of environment is really best suited for them?
It's a very difficult thing to explain. We have evidence that for people who are low in neuroticism that don't worry, it's easier for them to be in a calm environment. They don't have to use as much attention, and that leaves them the ability to restore their self-control. We're not sure what is happening with the highly neurotic people, although we have speculation. One speculation is that it's easy for them to pay attention to more dangerous cues. I mean, by dangerous, I just mean like a red light on a street. The neurotics have been shown, or people who are tending toward neuroticism, have been shown that it's easier for them, it takes less effort for them than other people to process these kinds of cues. I mean, they're on alert for them all the time.
So obviously this can help inform people like where they want to spend a vacation or maybe even where they want to live. But you're a professor in a business school. How would the business world potentially use this kind of information?
Many companies are developing or want to develop long-term relationships with consumers or buyers, and they want them to feel comfortable in their environment and to make good decisions so they come back and do it again. So there's one use for it. Another one is, what if you're the type of company where you're trying to help people have self-control? So if you're selling diet foods or a low-fat version of food, you want people to have self-control so they use your product. I think it's helpful for consumers to know what kinds of things to buy to give them the kinds of self-control that they might be looking for. Another interesting thing about neuroticism is that it can help companies with segmentation. So one thing that other people have found is that people's tendency towards neuroticism is different in different parts of the country. So in the Northeast, you have the highest levels of people who score highly on the neurotic scale. And here in Arizona, it's one of the low states for neuroticism.
You're going to market things differently in a place like New York City than a place like Phoenix or Tucson, for example.
Yeah, largely because the people are, well, they're different in many ways. But one of them being that they're comfortable and they search out more exciting things in New York. And people in Arizona and California as well are more likely to seek out and feel comfortable in more passive environments.
Would you imagine also that marketers might just market entirely different products to people in different parts of the countries?
Well, I would think they would market it differently. So if you have a diet food and you know people need self-control to actually eat it, you would advertise it in a more exciting way in a market where people tend towards neurotic than you would in an environment where people are not tending to be neurotic.
Mary Brooks is a professor in the Eller School of Management at the U of A. We'll post a link to the paper at theshow.kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News, to combat low 2015 cotton prices, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will provide a total of $300 million as a one-time assistance. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports starting this week, Arizona farmers can apply for the program.
Local farmers have a chance at the highest dollar per acre for their cotton grown last year. Arizona, along with California and New Mexico, can get up to $97 an acre. That's the highest regional payment allowed, almost double that of Mid-South states. But payments are capped at $40,000 per applicant. The higher amount in the West comes from regional costs of ginning cotton and how much more cotton per acre the area can produce. Here's Arizona Cotton Growers Association Director Rick Lavis.
We believe that this is an appropriate opportunity to strengthen the cotton industry in Arizona particularly.
Cotton prices have dropped sharply in the past few years because China controls the market. But the acres of cotton grown in Arizona this year have gone up. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The massacre at the gay bar in Orlando has focused attention once again on the antagonistic relationship between Islam and homosexuality. But if Islam and homosexuality sit uncomfortably together for ordinary Muslims, imagine how much tougher it must be for someone brought up to lead his Islamic community as a mullah. The BBC's Ali Hamadani has met such a man who's had to flee his home in Iran for the relative safety of Istanbul.
I did the similar story a few times before here in Turkey about Iranian LGBT refugees who fled Iran under the threat of being persecuted or for a better life. But this time I'm here to meet somebody from the hierarchy of Islamic regime who fled the country because of the same reason.
Taha is a cleric. I meet him in a mosque in Istanbul where he has come to pray. He tried to keep his sexual orientation quiet in Iran, but Taha's life was exposed, especially when he started conducting gay weddings in secret.
Yes, I did a few gay weddings. Last few months were very difficult. The authorities questioned me several times about my choice of friends. They were saying I'm a cleric and I shouldn't be meeting gay men. The other mullahs were suspicious about my sexual orientation and threatened me with death.
Taha came from a very religious family. He attended an Islamic school for future mullahs when he was just 15 and rose up the ranks to become a Hujjatul Islam, a respected authority in Islam.
I was different since I was a kid. I was feminine. I knew I was not interested in girls. When I went to high school and I got access to the internet, I learned more about the whole concept of being a gay man. At that time, I was studying in the Islamic school. I was very scared. I was crying for days.
Istanbul is unique in the Muslim world for its tolerance of homosexuality. Taha wants to take me to one of his favorite gay bars. But before that, he needs to get ready in his way. I am standing in front of a mirror with Taha. He has got a small bag full of makeup. Wow. Two lipsticks, mascara, eyeshadow, eyeliner, and powder. Wearing tight jeans, pink shirt, and an earring, Taha brings me to his favorite spot on Istiklal Street, famous for its gay scene. Venues like this are new in Istanbul as well. Now, we are sitting in one of them. On one side, I have Taha, the gay mullah. On another side, I have two Iranian gay refugees who fled from the country.
Ramtin left Iran a year ago and plans to get married to his partner. He hopes Taha will conduct their ceremony. For him, a gay mullah is a big deal.
It is very big. I am very happy about this. It is unbelievable. Before this, we knew mullahs as people who wanted to punish us. They prayed at our execution ceremonies. But now, we know someone who prays at our wedding ceremonies.
Farid, not his real name, left Iran 1 month ago. He's not out to his family and doesn't want to be identified.
It is very difficult for me to trust him because he is a mullah. I grew up in an atmosphere where they were part of the fears, lies, and duplicity in Iran.
What do you think?
Neither LGBT nor religious people accept me. Some Iranian LGBT do not trust me. That's very painful.
The city of 1,000 mosques is Taha's temporary home before he goes to his final destination, Canada. Will Iran ever accept Taha the way he is? Or is he too gay to be mullah and too mullah to be gay?
That's the BBC's Ali Hamedani. The FAA today released new rules for drone use. Before this, drones had been lumped in with manned aircraft. These new rules will govern who can fly the devices, what those pilots need to know, and what restrictions they'll face, among other things. To help break the new policy down, I'm joined by Matt Waite. He's a journalism professor and founded the Drone Journalism Lab in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And Matt, first off, what stands out to you?
The cost of entry into the drone marketplace has just suddenly come way down. Now, that's a double-edged sword. Currently, in order to be a commercial drone user, you have to have what's called a Section 333 exemption from the FAA. And to fly that drone, you actually have to be a manned aircraft pilot, which can cost about $10,000 to get if you're not already a pilot. So the barrier to entry to fly a $1,500 three-pound hunk of plastic on the ground is $10,000 or more. That keeps a lot of people out of the marketplace, and that makes prices go up because it's very hard to do that kind of work. Now you'll just need to take a knowledge test, which will only cost you about $150, And the number of people that can get into that marketplace goes way, way up.
So does that mean that we should be looking for more businesses that are looking to utilize drones in their business?
You're going to find them all over the place now. It's not going to be uncommon at all for you to see drones being used in businesses. Everything from, you know, roofing companies that want to go inspect a roof instead of putting an inspector on the roof, where a number of them fall off roofs every year and get hurt or even die, they can just send a drone to do it. If you've bought or sold a home lately, you're familiar with the home inspection process. Home inspectors have wanted to use these for a long, long time. Regulators, infrastructure managers, golf course owners, farmers, you name it. If there is a reasonable use for a camera that flies to get a bird's eye view of something, the cost of doing that has just come way, way down, and the number of opportunities has gone way, way up.
How will this all work together with the other stuff that is already in the sky?
Well, theoretically, drone pilots are supposed to stay at or below 400 feet above the ground, and manned aircraft pilots, the lowest they can be in a rural area, is 500 feet above the ground. So theoretically, there's a 100-foot buffer between them. For drone pilots that want to operate in an urban area, most of the time you're within 5 miles of an airport or you're in controlled airspace. To do that, you will have to get permission from the local air traffic control authority.
What, if anything, do these new regulations say about privacy? Because that was another concern that a lot of people had, that they didn't want drones like flying into their backyard, for example.
They say absolutely nothing about privacy. The FAA has said from the very beginning that they are not a privacy organization. They have no experience with privacy. They are a safety organization, and that's what they do, and that's what these regulations reflect. Generally, privacy has been left to the states. There is not an overarching federal privacy law that governs every one of us in the U.S. Every state has their own set of privacy laws and rules, and honestly, those change from state to state. That will continue. A number of states have passed privacy regulations in their state laws with regards to drones. You're honestly going to see a lot more of that now because the FAA didn't do anything about privacy, but that wasn't unexpected. State legislators will now have an incentive to get states involved. Honestly, that is a legally fraught area. You're going to see constitutional challenges with the First Amendment. You're going to see business interests opposed to certain small things, different things. You have to have a clear understanding of what a reasonable expectation of privacy is, and you also have to have a clear understanding of what these devices are and what they do. Some of the concern is based in the fact that we've all seen too many movies and we have some sort of Terminator idea of what these devices really are.
Matt Waite is a journalism professor and founder of the Drone Journalism Lab in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Babies aren't delivered at Phoenix Children's Hospital, but infants in need of intensive care are treated there. They sleep in small beds under soft lights, but instead of mobiles spinning above them, there are cameras. The show's Annika Klein tells us why.
Ashley Minton is a fourth grade teacher and a parent, and she calls her first pregnancy a textbook pregnancy.
She was normal, vaginal birth, all that kinds of normal stuff.
Her daughter Elizabeth is three now.
And then with my son, everything was completely different.
Michael required an emergency C-section, and he had health complications. He still does. It's been 8 months, and he's never been home. Instead, the Mintons have been to three different hospitals, trying to figure out what to do.
I think at least five times I've been told, your son's not going to make it.
The Mintons wanted to be by the baby's side as much as possible. Here at Phoenix Children's Hospital, they had the option of using a camera to watch Michael while they were away. They log into an online account on a phone or computer, and they can see him in real time.
It just adds a little bit more peace of mind. I know that the nurses are busy, and sometimes, you know, I'll try to call in, and they're doing cares, or, you know, so I can't talk to them and ask how he's doing.
The Mintons were part of the hospital's trial run for the cameras, but last week the system officially went online over 31 beds. It was set up with grant funding at about $1,000 a camera.
Parents are allowed in here 24/7, and we encourage that. There are just times when you can't be here.
That's Barb Harvey, manager of the Phoenix Children's Hospital Neonatal Intensive Care Unit, or NICU. Harvey says this has been a learning process for them as well as for parents, like when they realized some of the enclosed incubators would fog up.
Sometimes we use humidity in there for these babies, and they found out that you really can't see very well.
She says they get calls from worried parents when they see something they don't understand. A study published earlier this year in the Journal of Clinical Medicine and Research found at one hospital, using web cameras in the NICU increased nurses' workload and stress, partly due to calls from parents. Harvey says they're working on better ways to handle that so nurses can focus on care.
I'd say probably one of the biggest things I heard from other hospitals that successfully do it is you have to learn how to manage their expectations up front.
She says they'll let parents know that the cameras will be off during shift changes, for example, so nurses can focus on what they're doing and hand off to the next person. But she says overall, the benefits for families are worth it. Here's Minton again.
Every night, I log in from my phone and let my daughter give her brother a kiss goodnight.
The hospital has grant funding left over to set up cameras in other units, too. But soon, the Mintons won't need a camera. In just a week, Michael is finally scheduled to come home. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
It's the show on 91.5 with help from our partners at Arizona Highways Magazine. I'm Mark Brody. The Resolution Copper Mine is currently undergoing its federal environmental review. In addition to the concerns about the project expressed by some Native American tribes and environmentalists is the loss of rock climbing areas. Kurt Shannon is a policy analyst for the Access Fund. The nonprofit works to protect threatened rock climbing areas, including Oak Flat near the proposed mine. And Kurt, for climbers, how big of a deal is Oak Flat?
Well, Oak Flat is a very big deal. For 15 years, Oak Flat was the location of the world's largest rock climbing contest, the PBC. Towards the end, in 2004, the last contest, there were about 800 competitors and a couple of thousand spectators. So it was a big deal. People would come to that from all over the country.
What does it potentially mean for all of that if this Resolution Copper deal happens?
Well, if the mine goes ahead as planned, everything there would be lost. The entire Oak Flat area will subside into a huge crater, something like 1,000 feet deep and 2 miles across. So the loss would be very great. It would be, in fact, the largest loss of a climbing resource in the history of the United States.
There are obviously a lot of groups and a lot of individuals who are concerned about this. You have the Native American tribes, you have the copper company, you have environmentalists. Why should climbers sort of be on that list?
Well, I think there's sort of, if you look at objections to the mine, there are sort of three primary ways you could object to it. You can look at the environmental problems that'll be caused, the water pollution, the air pollution. You can look at the sacredness of the area. And then the third leg of that stool is the recreational loss. It's a very heavily used rock climbing area. It's also used very heavily by bird watchers, by campers, by hikers, by other people who use the area for recreation.
Do you think the concerns of recreationalists should be on the same level as like those who are concerned about the sacredness of the site and those who are concerned about the economic impact of a potential mine there and those who are concerned about other environmental factors?
Well, I think it certainly should be taken into consideration. I think it's additive. It's not like recreation is more important than the sacredness of the area or vice versa. It's, you know, there are all kinds of good reasons to oppose the project the way it's been proposed.
Are there other rock climbing sites either in that area or in other parts of Arizona that may gain in popularity if this one goes away?
There are other rock climbing areas in Arizona, certainly. I think all of the areas that are around Oak Flat would be very negatively impacted by this particular mine project.
But, I mean, do others potentially stand to gain if this one is sort of out of commission?
I guess, climbers will climb someplace if this area is lost. One of the tremendous losses associated with Oak Flat is that it is only 50 miles away from the fifth largest city in the United States. All of the other good rock climbing areas are substantially farther. So if you just want to hop in your car and be out and be climbing in an hour and then climb for a few hours and then go back home, there really aren't any other good areas like that near Phoenix.
Is there anything about the climbing there that climbers can't get or can't do somewhere else?
It's unique in a number of ways. I mean, all climbing areas are unique. This area is particularly important because it's vast. There are at least several hundred established rock climbs out there and several thousand what are called boulder problems, which are shorter climbs that are done without rope. So it's a vast area, and it's also, as I mentioned earlier, in very close proximity to a large city. So for both of those reasons, it would be tragic to have the area go away.
Kurt Shannon is a policy analyst for the Access Fund, which works to protect threatened rock climbing areas. But officials with Resolution Copper say climbing in the area will not go away. Vicky Pesey is senior manager of permitting and approvals for the Resolution Copper project. And Vicky, how big of a deal do you consider the concerns of rock climbing groups?
I think that's the best thing about the process that we have in the United States, and particularly the process that we're going to be going over. We're in the middle of the comprehensive environmental study under the National Environmental Policy Act. And so all concerns from all stakeholders, members of the public, everybody gets a chance to have their voice heard. So not just the Access Fund or other groups and organizations, but everybody. So there's a wide range of issues and concerns on this project, climbing being just one of many. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are also concerned about the economic impact and when the mine will actually start.
It sounds like, as far as the climbing goes, it's kind of a zero-sum game here, that if the mine opens and starts operating, the climbing goes away. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I think that couldn't be further from the truth. Certainly there are climbing values at Oak Flat, which is where the mine is located, and those specific climbing values are bouldering. But in the NEPA process, that is going to be assessed, and what we have to do is look for areas or other locations so we can offset and mitigate the loss of those climbing areas. And we've actually already been partnering with other groups and organizations and stakeholders, and we've found some additional bouldering locations. It's a matter of probably improving the access to them. And I think the other thing that kind of gets lost is on Resolution property, we have some of the best climbing routes and sport routes, traditional on our own property, that have been accessible for decades, and they won't be touched by the mining operation.
When you're looking for sort of replacement areas, what kinds of attributes do you look for to say, yes, this could be something that could make up for the potential loss of this site over here because of the mine?
Well, it's not just Resolution that does that. We partner with other climbing groups and organizations, one being the Queen Creek Coalition, which is a local climbing group, in order to look for, okay, so there's a bouldering area in this location, and this is kind of what the boulders look like, and we draw on their expertise to help us identify other areas that are similar to or have kind of like-for-like attributes. I think the other thing that's important in some of this is the Superior, there's been mining in this area for a century, right? We're in the historic Copper Triangle. Superior is one end of that triangle. And these are, mining has coexisted with these recreational values for a very long time. And we've been doing it for decades. There's no reason why we can't do that going forward. And really, that's what the NEPA process is all about.
Do you anticipate that, assuming the project goes forward, that quality and quantity will be roughly the same, if location will be different? Do you anticipate that quantity and quality will be the same going forward as they have been?
I think that one of the things we're working on is mining is an important part of the economy in the Copper Triangle in the Superior area. But what we want to do is look at diversifying the economy. And one thing is enhancing the recreational opportunities. So what our goal is to do is to not only replace like for like, but actually do better than and enhance the recreational opportunities that are here. And we're working with a lot of local stakeholders right now to do just that.
Vicky Pesey is Senior Manager of Permitting and Approvals for the Resolution Copper Project. You can read more about this in the June edition of Arizona Highways Magazine. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.